We are thankful for everybody's presence here. We hope that you will take out a Bible and follow along as we strive to teach God's Word and obey Him only. What we're going to do this morning is we're going to continue a series on the subject of Satan. About a month ago, I went insane and thought, you know, I'm going to do an exhaustive sermon on Satan and it'll be one sermon. And here we are on the fourth sermon in the series and we're still not going to finish this morning. Lord willing, though, next week we will bring this lesson, this series to an end. And what we've done, and since we're now on the fourth lesson, we're going to have to keep the review brief. But what we've looked at is we've seen this tremendous shift that occurred from the Old Testament to the New Testament and a recognition of our spiritual enemy. Old Testament really didn't talk about Satan all that much. New Testament, he's talked about tremendously more. We notice that he is a very real enemy. He is a dangerous threat. And that he is indeed very challenging to identify in our lives, for us to identify one particular moment and say, ah, this is Satan and this is him trying to do something in our life. He's a master of disguise. He's not going to be easy to discover that way. We noted that he is definitely a schemer. He has a plan and he's good at accomplishing it. And then last week what we observed was his tools, the methods that he uses to accomplish his will in our lives. And we looked specifically, we looked at Job and we examined what it was that Satan did when essentially God said, you will have your power unleashed. Do whatever you want to do to Job. And we see him using men and he's able to manipulate men and their actions. And we saw him using natural forces, the great powers in this world that he had access to. And we went beyond that and we observed things like he had the ability to take advantage of our weaknesses, of our flesh, and he had the ability to use death for his will. And the last thing I talked about last week was he uses us. And we just left it there and said, we'll talk about that next week. And that's what I want to talk about then now, is that Satan uses us to accomplish his will. This lesson is titled Giving Him an Opportunity, or Jumping in the Lion's Mouth, or Preparing Yourself for Failure. However you want to look at it, the Bible teaches us that we can empower Satan over ourselves. We can set ourselves up for failure. And obviously, we do not desire to do that. Well, Satan is an opportunist. This was something that we saw this morning when it was read in Luke chapter 4. We read the very end of the temptations of Jesus. And at the very end of that, verse 13, it says that Satan went away for a more opportune time. What was Satan doing the rest of the time in the Gospels? He was waiting, he was looking, he was seeking this opportunity when things were lined up to where he could manipulate things and get things the way he wanted them to be. In 1 Peter 5 and verse 8, we're told to be sober. Our adversary, the devil, is like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. He is always looking for opportunities. And the thing about Satan is he has proven to be a very adept enemy. Take the billions of people now, take all of mankind beforehand, and how many of us have managed to successfully thwart Satan every time? Romans 3 and verse 23 teaches us, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Bottom line is, everybody has failed when it comes to facing Satan, with the exception of Jesus. We have all failed at some point. And what my point with this is he doesn't need our help. He's already powerful. He's already capable. About the last thing we should be doing is making his job any easier. Thing is, he doesn't need our help, but he'll certainly take it. And we definitely offer it in our lives. And so there's many directions that I could go at this point, and I could talk about various subjects, but what I want to do is try to limit ourselves to what the Scriptures describes as opportunities we give Satan So we're limiting ourselves in this regard, but do understand that there's a lot more we could do. I want us to consider 7 points this morning. I know that's just a completely unscriptural number. It's supposed to be 3, right? Well, 7's a scriptural number, totally a scriptural number. So we're going to have 7 this morning. We're not going to spend a lot of time on each one as a result, but 7 things that we do to give Satan an opportunity. The first one we actually see Jesus doing. So it's not necessarily that these things are inherently sinful. They just give Satan an opportunity. What's the first thing we see Jesus doing to give Satan an opportunity? He doesn't eat. And he weakens himself. Now, I am convinced that this was the only way to make this at all a remotely even close, fair competition between Satan and Jesus. But in Matthew chapter 4, in verse 1, it says, "Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And after he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he then became hungry." And we talked about that last time, that this is different than the type of hunger you and I might be experiencing right now if we missed breakfast or if breakfast just happened to be a little too long ago. This is real starvation. This is real hunger. And it's at that point, in verse 3, it says, "The tempter came and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread.'" Let's not miss what Satan's temptation is there. First thing is, Jesus is now really, really hungry, and Satan goes after that point. So what we can do, if we want to lose, if we want to empower Satan over our lives, is we can weaken ourselves, make ourselves vulnerable. This is plain, simple, known psychology. Don't go to the grocery store when you're hungry, right? Do you make good decisions at the grocery store when you are hungry? How many of you, when you are hungry, go to the grocery store and say, "Salads"? We go to the grocery store and we start thinking, "Ding dongs, that's got to be healthy for me, right? That's what I'm really craving and what I'm wanting." When we're hungry, we have allowed ourselves the opportunity, not allowed ourselves, what we have done is we have opened up ourselves to advertisers. They crave for you to show up hungry because they have all these images and all these things that say, "Ooh, you want this, you need to have this." And every aisle you go on, you have weakened yourself because you're hungry. Well, can't that principle apply spiritually? Do you not see that in your life? I consider this. I don't like driving while I'm in a hurry. I don't like driving while I'm in a hurry because I drive differently. And if I see somebody who's on the side of the road who needs help, it's hard for me to say, "Yes, I'll help them." Why? Because I'm in a hurry. If somebody cuts me off, it's hard for me to be patient. Why? Because I'm in a hurry and now they're in my way. And I have opened myself up for not living the way I ought to live simply because I'm running behind. It's a minor thing, but we're opening ourselves up. Or how about if you live a life in which you are really stressed and overwhelmed? Do you ever find yourself mistreating the people around you? Bringing your stress home and taking it out on your family members? What have you done? Now, we can't control these things entirely. We aren't always in control, but as much as we can, live a life that is not overwhelmed and not filled with constant things that cause us stress, we ought to. We ought to avoid those things because they're just giving Satan an opportunity. As much as we can, we ought not be living a life in which we are constantly running behind and in a hurry and opening ourselves up to these negative temptations. I want to consider some, really this point sets a basis, a principle that flows through the rest of the points, or most of these. And the next one is definitely a direct application of this. And it's 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and it's talking about spousal responsibilities. And when we neglect them, we give Satan an opportunity. Is that not what is taught here? Let's look over here, 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Remember, Corinth, we're talking about a world that is very sensually corrupt. It says, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of immoralities, and one of the failures of the New American Standard, I think many of you probably have a better translation there, but because of sexual immoralities, fornications, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But this I say by way of concession, not of command. Yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. And he's going to go on in 1 Corinthians 7. He's going to set down this basic principle. It says, look, if you're really having trouble with sexual desires, there's a solution for you. It's called marriage. Is that not this principle that says, go through life and we fulfill our desires in a righteous way so that we take away Satan's opportunities? Marriage is the opportunity. But then he says, within marriage, you don't always fulfill your duties to one another, and you need to. Now, we frequently look at this passage, and I think correctly so. We talk about sexual desires, and rightly so, because that's really his main point. But is it limited to that? Is that really the only need that exists within marriage that we ought not be depriving one another? Men most frequently need respect. And when the women don't show the men the respect they need, there's an opportunity that Satan sees. I can find a way to give that man the respect that he's craving. I can find a way to make him feel really important, make him feel really good about something. I can give him another woman. And don't women, don't they need something else? Don't they frequently need compassion and affection? And if the man is depriving the woman of that, is that not just creating an opportunity for Satan saying, oh, so you're not going to listen to your wife. You're not going to spend time with your wife. Well, guess what? I've got these guys over here who will. I'm not saying that every affair that has ever occurred on earth is because we're depriving one another. But I will say this. When we deprive one another, we increase the opportunities for Satan significantly. And so Paul says, stop it. Don't do that. Don't give Satan an opportunity like that. We'll go on to the next point in Ephesians chapter 4. Prolonged anger. What's it result in? So Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 26 and 27 says, be angry, yet do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger, and do not give the devil an opportunity. So here he's talking about we can, through our anger, give Satan an opportunity in our lives. It's not wrong to be angry. There are times when we should be. I mean, this passage right there, Ephesians 4, verse 26, says, be angry, but do not sin. There are times to be angry. I think about what is stated in 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 7 and 8, when it's talking about Lot and how he was witnessing the horrendous things that were occurring in Sodom. Every day he was seeing the sensual, sinful, unholy activities, and it vexed his soul. I think we could translate that as it made him angry. It's not wrong to be angry. In fact, there are times that we ought to be angry. But what we must be very careful about is how long we are angry for. So what he says there in Ephesians 4, verse 26 and 27, he says, do not let the sun go down on your anger, and do not give the devil an opportunity. I don't like to talk about politics. I'm going to right here, right now, for a very simple reason. I've heard it from you. I have heard it from myself. Very few people talk about politics and have this great, wonderful time. Few people say, do you know what I just love? It just makes me feel so good. Let's talk about politics today. No, a bubbling underneath the surface, ready to explode at any moment, is anger over the direction of this government. And it's funny because it doesn't matter which political party you're a part of. Almost everybody I've talked to, that's the case with them. There's this anger that exists, and sometimes you bring up one subject and boom, you have a heated argument and everybody agrees with each other. But we're still going to have this heated argument. That means that there's this anger that is swelling inside us. And yes, there's times to be angry, there's ways to be angry, but we must be careful that we don't hold on to that anger because it will not do us good. Well, what did James say in James 1, verses 19 and 20? Be quick to hear and slow to speak and slow to anger, because the anger of man does not accomplish the righteousness of God. We may be angry for good reasons, but if we hold on to that anger, will it accomplish good? Will it make our lives better? Will it make us more righteous? Will it help this world at all? Or will what we have done is exactly what Ephesians warns us? If we hold on to this anger, whether it be politics or whether it be somebody has hurt you or somebody has done something you didn't appreciate or cut you off or whatever it is in the world, if we hold on to that anger, have we really done anything more than this? Jumped into the lion's mouth and said, chew me up. I'm yours. Anger, holding on to anger, is giving the devil an opportunity. We'll continue on to the fourth point, idle hands. And so in 1 Timothy chapter 5, Paul is giving the church instructions as to which widows it is able to assist. And that sounds really weird because you would think, well, it's a good work to assist widows. But we find that the church is not what we think. It is God's organization and it is God's work that He gives it, and He has His reasons. And so here are these widows that the church is supposed to not assist. And you know why? It's to not give Satan an opportunity, is one of the reasons why. So in verses 9 and 10, he gives the qualifications for those whom you can assist as a church. But then in verse 11, he focuses on one particular qualification. Of all of the ones he gave, there's one particular one he focuses on, and that is age. Now, that doesn't mean that the other qualifications don't have their reason. He just says there's a reason why I put an age limit on this. They must be over 60 years old. Here's why. He goes on, he says, refuse to put younger widows on the list, for when they feel sensual desires in disregard of Christ, they want to get married, thus incurring condemnation because they have set aside their previous pledge. At the same time, they also learn to be idle as they go around from house to house, and not merely idle, but also gossips and busybodies, talking about things not proper to mention. Therefore, I want younger widows to get married, bear children, keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach, for some have already turned aside to follow Satan. Is he not really just teaching there that I want the younger women to keep themselves busy with good, productive things so that they do not give Satan an opportunity? Is that not what he essentially said there? It's a principle that we've taught, that perhaps you have heard before. Idle hands are the devil's playground. And we could apply it beyond just this particular subject, but you look at teenagers that are off on the streets at nighttime and have nothing to do. How often do they come up with charities to form? When you have nothing good to do, when you're not doing anything good, you don't tend to find good things to do. You tend to find bad things to do. What you are doing is you are giving yourself opportunity to fall to Satan. You're giving him opportunity over you. And so idle hands, when we're not busy doing productive, good, righteous things. And notice he's not talking about major things here. He's not talking about something that is just out of the ordinary. He's just talking about things that are the role of a woman in this case, or it could be the role of a man, or whatever it may be in the different context. Fulfill your role in society. The fifth point is from 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 6 through 11. And this is a passage that we've looked at many times as well in this series. You might recall that in 1 Corinthians, Paul has dealt with the people of Corinth and he has observed their sinfulness. There is somebody within them that is living in a sinful way, and they needed to take action. And I admit that this is based on inference. I'm just trying to understand what happened, piece together what has occurred between 1 and 2 Corinthians. But it certainly seems, to the glory of God, the people obeyed Paul. And they took action against this sinner, and to the glory of God, he changed. And so it says in verse 6, sufficient for such a one is the punishment which was inflicted by the majority. So that on the contrary, you should rather forgive and comfort him. Otherwise, such a one might be overwhelmed by excessive sorrow. Wherefore, I urge you to reaffirm your love for him. For to this end also I wrote, so that I might put you to the test whether you are obedient in all things. But one whom you forgive anything, I forgive also. For indeed, what I have forgiven, if I have forgiven anything, I did it for your sakes in the presence of Christ, so that no advantage would be taken of us by Satan, for we are not ignorant of his schemes. Well, honestly, I actually am a little bit. I don't know entirely what Satan is trying to accomplish there, but I do know that what it is saying here is, if you don't take this action, and here's this repentant sinner, and if you don't bring them back, you are giving Satan an opportunity. In what way? Well, I see two ways specifically. One is, you're giving Satan the opportunity to squash a broken man. To take this person who wants to come back to God and overwhelm him with excessive sorrow so he just quits. And I want you to remember, ever since the sacrifice of Jesus, Satan's ultimate goal, it's not enough to get us to sin. He has to get us to quit. Because if we sin, we can be like Peter. Peter denied Jesus 3 times, but he was able to come back and be an apostle. But if we quit, we're Judas. Judas denied Jesus. Judas betrayed Jesus, and he didn't come back. He just hung himself. He died. And Jesus said, it would have been better for you if you'd never been born. So if somebody has sinned, and we look at them and they're coming back and we just say, oh, it won't last. They don't really mean it. It was really bad what they did. It was really disgusting and we don't welcome them back. Then what we are doing is we are giving Satan an opportunity. Second way I think that this would apply is in regards to our own selves. In Matthew chapter 6, verse 14 through 15, Jesus sets forth a principle, a rule. If you don't forgive others, you won't be forgiven. And we're giving Satan an opportunity to point at us, to accuse us, and to say, look, see, they are not merciful. They deserve no mercy. They are not forgiving. They do not deserve forgiveness. They cannot have forgiveness. Either which way, Paul is saying that through this process, they're giving Satan an opportunity. The sixth thing that I want to say actually relates to what we talked about last week. Satan's great power in Hebrews chapter 2. The great power that God has essentially taken away from him, but it still exists. And he still can have it over any one of us, and that is the power of death, or the fear of death, is what the Hebrew author points out. And so Hebrews chapter 2, verse 14, he says, therefore, since the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise also partook of the same, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is, the devil, and might free those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. So Jesus has come in, and this gets into next week's lesson. Jesus has come in and rendered Satan powerless. Next week is victory over Satan. How do we get it? The promise that we can. But right here, Jesus has accomplished it. He's taken away the power of death. And devil is the one who uses the power of death. Well, we know that still exists to some degree, right? Because we still die. All of us still die. But what he says there in verse 15, it might free those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. When we are afraid of dying, we empower Satan in our lives. I guess, you know, it's pretty natural, isn't it? It's pretty common to be afraid of death. But what we do is we empower one of Satan's most frequently used powers. We so frequently think of Satan as using the temptation of pleasure. That is only one side of Satan's tools. The other side is Satan uses pain. Satan uses the fear of death. Consider Peter. Jesus has been arrested, and Peter is at a distance. He doesn't know what to do. And somebody comes up to him and says, "You were with Jesus." That temptation is not, "Hey, you want some pleasure?" That temptation is, "You are going to face death if you say, 'Yeah, I know Jesus. I was with him.'" What kept Peter from saying, "I know the Lord," but fear of death? That's what Satan uses. That is the power of persecution. The power of persecution is to get people to be afraid to die. And look what happens in Matthew chapter 10. Jesus is sending out his disciples, his apostles, to go prepare the way for him, to go out and declare the message that Jesus is coming. And as he sends them out, he then prepares them for what they're going to face. He prepares them for the challenges. And what we're going to notice is we're going to get down to verse 28, where he says, "Do not fear those who kill the body." He's saying there, don't fear death. But look at how it all connects together. Matthew chapter 10, verse 16, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. So be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves. But beware of men, for they will hand you over to the courts and scourge you in their synagogues, and you will even be brought before governors and kings for my sake as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. But when they hand you over, do not worry about how or what you are to say, for it will be given to you in that hour what you are to say. For it is not you who speak, but it is the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. Brother will betray brother to death, and father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. You will be hated by all because of my name, but it is the one who has endured to the end who will be saved. But whenever they persecute you in one city, flee to the next. For truly I say to you, you will not finish going through the cities of Israel until the Son of Man comes. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a slave above his master. It is enough for the disciple that he become like his teacher, and the slave like his master. If they called the head of the house Beelzebul, how much more will they malign the members of his household? Therefore, do not fear them. For there is nothing concealed that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known. What I tell you in the darkness, speak in the light, and what you hear whispered in your ear, proclaim upon the housetops. Do not fear those who kill the body, but are unable to kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a cent? Are not one of them, not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father, but the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So do not fear. You are more valuable than many sparrows. Therefore, everyone who confesses me before men, I will also confess him before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will also deny him before my Father who is in heaven. Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. What kind of a pep talk was that? Here, I want you to go out and I want you to proclaim the gospel, and everybody's going to listen to you, and the kingdom's going to come, and it's going to be great. That's a pep talk, right? No, this is the way to make it successful, though, is what stands between you and salvation is fear of death. Because you are going to be persecuted. You are going to suffer. Satan is going to come after you. The people are going to reject you. But you need to understand this. The reward is not in this life. Do not fear the person who all they can do is kill you. Because Jesus says, if you confess me, I will confess you before my Father. He's talking about a spiritual reward, a greater reward, a reward that comes after death. In this world, as we become more and more physically minded, I hate to say it, but is it not the truth? That we are more and more material minded. More and more, we do not look to death as an opportunity to go to heaven, but we do not desire death. We do not want it. We want to prolong our life. And it's not terribly wrong because life is good. Life is what God gave us. Death is God's enemy. But the real life isn't found in this time. It isn't found in this life. And as long as we focus more and more on this life and fear more and more death, we are making Satan stronger and stronger and stronger. And on that day of persecution, which may come in our time period, it already exists in our time period in other places of the world. But if we fear death, we have given Satan his greatest power over us. So we must not fear death. And the final thing I'll say, as the first one you'll notice, being weakened, was this principle that kind of followed through in these others. And all these other passages, at least many of them, have already actually been setting up this last principle as well. And that is, we give Satan an opportunity by being a tool against others. Some of these things weren't about giving Satan an opportunity in your life. Some of them were about giving Satan an opportunity in others. Take what we've already talked about multiple times in this series, Peter. Jesus has declared to Peter in Matthew 16, I'm going to go to Jerusalem and I'm going to die. I'm going to be arrested. I'm going to suffer. I'm going to die. I'm going to be resurrected. And what does Peter do? Peter steps in and he rebukes him and he says, no, God forbid that. And Jesus says to him, get behind me, Satan. He doesn't say, watch out, Satan's tempting you, Peter. What he is saying is, Peter has become a tool of Satan against Jesus. Because he has set his sight, his thoughts, on man's will rather than on God's. Well, consider what we were looking at in those passages. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 5. This passage about not depriving one another within the spousal relationship. It's not just about ourselves, it's about our spouse. If we deprive one another, we have given not just an opportunity in ourselves, but we've given an opportunity in our spouse. We've allowed Satan to be stronger in his attack against the person we love. We've become their enemy. In 2 Corinthians 2, verses 6 through 11, it was about the church not welcoming back somebody who is sinning. Somebody who is repenting of their sins. And now we have become their enemy, strengthening Satan's attack against them. In 1 Timothy 5, verses 11 through 15, it's talking about the church and its responsibility towards younger widows. And the danger is the church, if it takes care of those younger widows, is strengthening the opportunity of attack from Satan against that young widow. Yeah. Satan's tools is us. He will use us against ourselves. He just waits for us to give him opportunity. Satan's tool is us. He will wait for us to give him opportunity against the very people we love and care about the most. So God has warned us we have a real enemy. And he's a schemer. And he's really capable and he's really powerful. Don't help him out. You know, we can't avoid temptation, not totally. Satan's not going to quit just because it's not easy to tempt us. But does that mean we shouldn't spend part of our life focusing on, let's not make it easy for him. Let's not help him. Consider these ways. Think about additional ways within God's Word and within your life that we empower Satan in our life. Let's fight back. Let's start off by resisting giving him opportunities. Next week, Lord willing, we will conclude this series on a very positive note, I hope, and it is this: victory against this great enemy can be ours. And I hope you will join us for that next week. I thank you very much for your time, for your attention, and I hope that you will study these things, and more importantly, I hope that we will apply them to our lives. Now, if you are not a Christian, whether you recognize it or not, you are Satan's tool. You are Satan's friend. You are Satan's follower. And you are God's enemy. You've made yourself God's enemy. And we want to give you an opportunity to change. To change sides and to find salvation in Jesus. So if you're not a Christian, this is your opportunity. If you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, we invite you to come forward to confess that faith, to repent of your sins, and to be baptized into Christ. And all those sins and all those things you've done against God are washed away, gone. And you are God's. You're His soldier. You're His child. You're on His side. And we desire to help you in that fight against Satan and that fight for good for God. And if you are a Christian and you have fallen away, you haven't done anything nobody else has ever done. We've all done it. We've all sinned. We've all fallen away. And what we see here within this passage of 2 Corinthians was this responsibility we have to help you. If you will repent, we want to fight Satan. We want to forgive. We want to help. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?
Longer be light in a city so bright.